And thank you to Christine Young for joining us today. Christine and I met about, I don't know, about 5 years ago or so when we were doing a hackathon together. And Christine, she's the president of Blue Compass, which is an IT consulting firm that specializes in data science and innovation management. And she's always been doing a lot of very interesting things. She consults. She uses Blue Compass's innovation and data skills. She does all sorts of things. And today we're going to talk a little bit about hackathons, and we're going to talk about child trafficking and a couple hackathons that she's been a part of and been instrumental in coordinating. And so welcome, Christine. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Yeah. So, let's kind of get to the heart of it, right? So hackathons in a virtual environment, it sort of sounds redundant to some ways, because we have, you know, there are companies out there like organizations like virtual hackathons and folks like that run virtual hacks all the time. Maybe you can help kind of describe a little bit about the difference between a virtual hackathon and a real hackathon for those that are not familiar with hackathons.
Yeah, sure. So normally, you know, a hackathon is a time when geeks come together and build things, and we'll throw data, apps, a challenge at folks, and then maybe like 36 hours later, they'll come up with an idea. So when we do these hackathons, the benefit of doing it in person, you get to talk to people, you can talk to end users. A lot of times we have people from industry like IBM, Adobe. We had Elasticsearch and Recorded Future in the last one. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of people that come to the table and will just be there for educational purposes. So that really organic conversation is really beneficial when you're like trying to talk to the end users for the usability side of it, and then the technology people for the technical side of it. So by moving it to virtual, like creating those organic conversations to virtual is, you know, a lot harder. And then virtual hackathons have a stigma too, because usually it's all about that prize purse. Like, I'm there to get that $1,000 or $5,000. And there isn't much interaction with the host of the hackathon or anybody else, really. So actually, the winner of our last hackathon, they told us when we decided to go virtual, they decided that they weren't going to do it. And then the day before, they're like, oh, let's give it a try. And then they joined. And then they were really happy about it. So, there was a lot of elements where we used the heck out of Slack and WebEx, and just did a lot of outreach and did a lot of connecting, so that like people who, I would say, like, you know, most people who come to hackathons aren't necessarily the most outgoing. And so knowing that, you know, we were a little bit more friendly without being overbearing. And I think people really appreciated that. So.
Yeah, you bring up a great point. You know, it's like in the hacks that I've been to, it always seems like there's that one kind of connector person on the successful teams that is able to, you know, be the really effective communicator. I'm curious, you know, as we're in this different era where communication is, you know, it's hard to grab a hold of your arm and shake you and go, hey, Christine, what's going on? You know, how do you see that playing out? You know, the communication changes that we have to do to be able to, like you said, you were going out of your way to be more friendly on the most recent virtual hack that you did. Maybe you can describe, you know, some of the different approaches that you've taken to actually doing that deeper level of communication virtually. It's a skill by itself, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it definitely takes a lot more energy, because your intention is laid out up front. You can't just, you know, walk across someone's desk, or if I go to the snack table, you know, that organic conversation doesn't happen about like, hey, I had trouble with that hash too. Like, what did you do with that? So So what we did was, like, people were open to chatting in the different Slack channels, and we had a Slack channel for brainstorming, Slack channel for teaming, and just made it very, like, the intention of each conversation was there. So at least people weren't shy about bringing up conversations, especially with the teaming. It's hard to get to know people over, you know, over the computer. Yeah. So we also made resources like readily available for people. So, if they wanted like their, video conferencing, and with, the free version of Slack, you can only do one-on-one. You can't do group, but we had our WebEx channels ready for them, 'cause we had a license for that. So we were able to give people video conferencing, to meet people for the first time. And then also, like we, made those one-on-one connections with people. So, there were about, 8 of us that were, kind of doing the background conversations and seeing like who needed what. And so I think people appreciated that. And then, people started to open up during the hackathon. And we noticed like people posting like, you know, this was helpful for me. I hope it'll be helpful for you. And also, the generational sharing was really, it was outstanding. Like we saw 14-year-olds talking to 60-year-olds. We actually had a mother-daughter team that wasn't like teenage daughter. It was like, I would say she's in her mid-30s, and her mom was close to, she was definitely over 50, maybe almost 60. So, like that was really cool to see that, like, you know, the multi-generational, aspect was there. So yeah, it didn't matter, who people were, even skill set. There were newbies, there were people who didn't code at all, and they were paired with someone who coded. And they learned something out of that as well. So, yeah, it was pretty cool. Multidiscipline, multigenerational, multiracial, everything. It was cool.
What was the outreach like to get that kind of demographic that you did from all these different people? Where did you have specific focus groups or you know, gaming communities or at home coders, that type of thing? How did you reach that kind of diverse set of individuals coming?
From our hackathon circuit that we've been doing the past couple of years, we have almost 4,000 people in our district list. And then like from all the different cities that we went to. And then this previous one, we paired up with George Mason Policy School. They're on the Arlington campus in Virginia. Their professors are part of this like transnational crime center school, and they shared it with their group. We also paired with Georgetown Data Science, we presented to 3 different cohorts. So there was an academic outreach, and then with high schoolers, just through like the different social media channels, we had a TJ group. Basically share it with their friends. And so we had a good number of TJ kids show up. That's Thomas Jefferson. I don't know if this is a Virginia crowd for your readers. I'll just assume that, but yeah. So TJ is
actually, but
yeah. So I should probably explain. So yeah, TJ is the magnet school nearby. And then the professional outreach, just a recorded future showed up in force. They had like, I would say like 20 people show up. Wow. And you know, part of it was like they were showing the capability of Recorded Future, which was like really awesome. They were showing a relationship with like open source, and so they sponsored, but then also like they competed too. And you could see like the quality of their projects come out at the end when they were demoing. So it was cool.
So how do you get sponsors for this, right? So is it topic driven? Is it, you know, somebody just happens to have, you know, some advertising or, you know, BNP money laying around and it's like, oh, I want to go spend it on that. Or you know, how do you approach, you know, getting sponsors?
So
your secret sauce, I'm just saying,
yeah, you know, there's no secret sauce. I feel like I'm begging for money with finding sponsors, but that's how we fund our hackathons. And a topic like child trafficking, I feel like anybody is willing to help out with that. Like that one kind of speaks for itself. Mm. And basically any technology you can make useful, like Mapbox was a sponsor. And, you know, with mapping tools, you can definitely find use for that. And then like things like environmental conservationism, like a lot of times corporations, they might have some CSR component to what they do, like corporate social responsibility. So yeah, depending on what their interests are for the technology side. And then depending on what the topic is, we'll engage with NGOs, academia, and that kind of drives who the sponsors would be too, because a lot of times the sponsors are the ones that want to sell to the NGOs or academia or government. So,
yeah. So you end up with some version of an end result, something that gets judged. Mm-hmm. How do you go about setting the judging criteria? Right. Cause you usually publish that ahead of time. Yeah. Right? So do you come up with that, or is it with you and the sponsors, or how does that work?
So our criteria is typically the same. There's a usability component, a technology component, and creativity. So there's four different criteria, and we only add criteria if there is a sponsor that is specifically sponsoring a prize for the end. So I'm trying to think of an example, because I remember there were... there were some people who wanted to, IBM, for instance. So IBM, their Watson APIs, mm-hmm. They said like, you know, we'll give $1,000 for the best use of Watson APIs. And that year, somebody created a software that was meant to go into a hotel lobby to scan faces. And if there was ever a match with someone in like a human trafficking database, then that alerted law enforcement. Mm-hmm. So that was a pretty cool use of Watson API, facial recognition. When they do that, then we'll add to the criteria.
So. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. So, you know, mm-hmm. I know we kind of jumped straight into the, you know, talking about, you know, what's going on with virtual hackathons in the land of COVID that we still sit in. Maybe we take a step back for a minute and you kind of talk about how did you get into the whole hackathon thing in the first place? Mm-hmm. Right. So, and then talk about, you know, your journey into hacks and a little bit about your background, because I thought your background was pretty cool.
Which background? Like software background?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I started off as a coder, graduated out of Carnegie Mellon. And when I graduated, I was doing, all sorts of software development for the government. And then I decided I wanted to talk to people more. and went into requirements, but like that wasn't satisfying me. So then went into strategy, and then went to Gartner and did basically C-level consulting. From Gartner, like with the strategy piece, I don't know, they kind of breed entrepreneurs out of there because people, they eat what they kill. You know, you get the work, you do the work, you close the projects. That was like a good launching pad into starting my own company. So hackathons was something that I just saw was something fun to do. And you don't just have to be a coder. Like you can be a coder, a designer, a subject matter expert. And I saw it as a good way of collaborating, but the government wasn't doing it very much. I had pitched the idea to a federal agency, and they weren't asking for it. There wasn't an RFP for it or anything. So I pitched the idea. It ended up taking 4 years to get on contract. That's the way.
All right. Yeah. You get it done quickly, actually.
Yeah, so that's from like, you know, the government wasn't even asking for it. But, you know, those 4 years actually went by pretty quick. But we got a 2-year contract out of that, doing hackathons around the country, trying to connect the federal government to new ideas and new people. So that was really great. And then for the hackathons, the way to get hackers there, we made the topics interesting and, you know, sexy enough for people to show up. And so we always put a social impact theme to it. So all of our hackathons have some kind of social impact and, like, you know, whether it's human trafficking, food security, environmental conservationism, there's a lot that that people will spend a weekend to help, and, you know, first responders, like, you know, who would deny a first responder? So we always, you know, do something where the federal government would get out of it, industry gets something out of it, and then also NGOs and local government, they don't get second helpings or, you know, sloppy seconds with technology. They get cutting edge. So I really like that, giving NGOs, you know, a cutting edge advantage.
No, that's one of the things I like about it too, right? So, you know, maybe talk a little bit about expedition hacks too, right? So that's something that you're helping, you know, continue to make happen, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Expedition Hacks is our hackathon series. And so that's our brand, for the hackathons. So we do it around the country. We're always looking for, people that want to do good with their technology. So, you know, we don't seek out, people that are just trying to push their software out or whatever. But always, in our, each hackathon has an outreach component to academia. So always trying to give back to students as well, and also try to help them find jobs. That's very important. No, especially in this age.
I just remembered that you were pretty adamant about that. And the first time I met you when we were doing that hack, it was literally 5 years ago. I just went and looked. I was like, wow, I can't believe that was actually that long ago. But that was one of the first things I remember about you, Christine, is that you were insistent that there was going to be a meet and greet with as many luminaries as we could find. And we did that. And it worked out great because everybody loved it, right? Mm-hmm. And that particular hack, the interesting thing was the team of interns are the ones that won that one, right? So mm-hmm. even we had professional hack teams showing up from, I think they came in from Georgia, et cetera. And it was the interns that won. So it was kind of cool watching students win that. Talk to us a little bit about the topic that we named this, socially conscious geeks bring down global criminals, right? Okay. So here we are, you know, 20 minutes into our discussion, and we haven't even mentioned the main topic, which was human trafficking, right? So I know of at least two that you've done with both, I think, with George Mason, one in person in 2018. The other one was the virtual one you just finished. Can you talk a little bit about the topic of human trafficking, how that kind of got on your radar, and kind of walk us through the first one that you did?
Yeah. So I actually went to a human trafficking conference at Catholic University like 5 or 6 years ago. And I was compelled to do something about it. And, you know, I'm not a social worker. I'm not in the federal government working on human trafficking. But I have this company and we were doing hackathons at the time. So that just naturally, came together. So human trafficking is, the second biggest global crime. And it's a second to drug trafficking. And there's actually a lot of overlap, with drug trafficking. Because it is so profitable, you have gangs that actually work together. Like, you know, when you ever think of gangs, they're always, you know, combating each other and they're always trying to get profit over each other. But because human trafficking is so profitable, they are working together to recruit. And so it's actually a very dangerous thing because it's very out in the open and it's right under our noses and we just don't realize it. And not until I started to learn more about the subject did I realize that it's actually a huge thing in the DC area, especially in Northern Virginia. And there's ways that they are recruiting that are actually specific to our local area. Like, for instance, recruiting high school girls you think like, you know, it's the guy that's going to the malls and, you know, looking for girls that look weak, which they are doing, by the way. But in addition to that, they're looking for the girl that, they'll tell the girl, like, if you tell your family, what is going on here, I'm going to chop off your brother's hand. And so what ends up happening is they're working for the Johns during the day when they're supposed to be in school, and they go home every night to their own bed, to their own home. So their parents aren't even aware or even like, you know, that they're not suspicious of anything. They just work things out, and they understand what the parents are looking for, and then they work around that. So, you know, that's a very scary thing. So we have to teach our children earlier. And people are talking about, like, you talk to your kids before fourth grade about sex, and then you tell them early about there are these bad people that try to do X, Y, and Z. So, you know, it changes the way that you yourself operate. And there's just, you know, operational security that you just need to know for yourself and for your kids, so that, you know, if they spot something or if they walk into a situation, they know how to get out of it. So, you know, what is the role of technology in that? Because, you know, kids always have their phones. There's a lot of facial recognition software out there, vehicle recognition software. So how do you put those things together to work in favor of law enforcement, in favor of social workers? And, you know, you don't want them to have the sloppy seconds for technology, because, you know, if it ever comes down to you yourself or someone that you know or someone in your family, you want the best technology out there. So, yeah, so that's how the human trafficking topic.
Mm-hmm. Christine, I want to go back to what you said about Northern Virginia, and it's right under our noses here. And I was in a human trafficking seminar hosted by one of the high schools. I brought my middle school daughter to it just to kind of get her aware of how serious this stuff is. And although the group, and honestly, I can't remember which group actually hosted the events, but there were some local county officials in Loudoun County who participated in it, but they seemed to kind of downplay its prominence within the area. Like, we don't have cases like this around here, you know. I mean, but I was like, well, that's counter to the group to talk about it. So what's going on? And it also highlighted a lot of other issues of where do you even get data to figure out where these issues are occurring. And I understand there's a lot of layers to this, such as the law enforcement doesn't actually keep track and record human trafficking. If it's a different type of crime, even though it's associated with human trafficking, may not get labeled as such, and they may not even categorize it as human trafficking until after someone's charged, prosecuted, etc. Right? So, so how do we keep track of how many cases are locally? How do we create more awareness that this stuff is actually going on from a data and technology perspective? Because I think even law enforcement and county officials are just understating the fact, or maybe they're just lack of awareness of how bad this is.
Yeah. So Polaris is a group that runs the National Human Trafficking Hotline. So they have a lot of data in terms of cases reported. So they can show, like, in terms of location to geographically where the clustering happens. But Polaris, they've identified 25 different types of human trafficking. So usually what people do is label either sex trafficking or labor trafficking. But then they go into the nuances of massage parlors, and then like different types of labor trafficking. You could argue that, even labor trafficking, like the speaker that we had, a human trafficking survivor in the last one, she's labeled as a labor trafficking survivor. But she was, her employer raped her. And so she said, like, labor trafficking victims are often, like, it may not be as frequent as someone who's labeled as a sex trafficking victim, but they still go through horror all the time. It depends on how the data is captured. And then also Fairfax County, their human trafficking department was one police officer. He was Detective Bill Wolf at the time. And now he works at the Justice Department. But he was a division of one officer, even though this area has been noted on several lists as the second highest trafficking activity in the country. So if you don't have somebody capturing the data, then, like, you know, it's not going to be, it's going to be captured as some other crime. And also, like, you know, one sex trafficking crime might be a combination of, you know, several crimes together. So yeah, the way that the data is captured, it's not consistent. And so that's part of the problem. But then when it comes to like Super Bowl time or, you know, some other sporting event where there's been a spotlight that sex trafficking happens, then, like, you know, all of a sudden all this data comes out and there is a lot of sex trafficking data that comes from that just because people expect it and then they put a lot of resources to it. So, yeah.
So what the data stuff. So if you have any acts that you raise.
Sorry, go ahead, John.
Yeah, no, I was just wondering, you know, for the hacks that you ran, what data did you find or what data were provided to the folks at the hacks? Can you describe the data?
Yeah, so we had a lot of open source data. That's always where we go first. For like HHS has data, USAID has a lot of data for like global data. Mm-hmm. Data.gov, there's like, you know, so much there. We had one group, Nova HTI, that provided data called from RubMaps. And so that was like data that we had to check their ID to make sure that they were over 18. But basically it was for the ads. They scraped data, basically. In 2018, there was another data provider that donated scraped data from like Backpage, and which is down now, Backpage and SE and Craigslist. There's a lot of data providers that that will donate data to us. But it's hard to call data, like, you know, human trafficking data, because there's so much different data that you could use. There's a lot of data that we had. We had a whole Slack channel just devoted to data sharing. So
is there some kind of effort to aggregate this all and standardize a single data front for people to use?
People talk about that all the time. The problem is data capture, where the data resides. And then some people, once they get good data and it's usable, then they want to sell it. So, it's part of the industry problem, I guess.
Oh, understood. I just, from the topic, I'm not sure that's something that should be sold just because of the lack of awareness out there, but that's just me personally. I mean, and then I kind of want to go back to, I mean, just it's such a struggle to get data even out of local law enforcement. And promote exposure of this. I think that's also just the market, the numbers and the market, what's going on. I think that's just as important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's actually data providers for this topic that's specific to law enforcement. Like, they see law enforcement as an end user, and they won't charge a lot, I've noticed, but still, I mean, they're working too, you know, like they need to pay their workers, but data, good data doesn't come free. So, unfortunately,
that's probably an understatement of the year right there. The hack that was done in 2018, good end result. You decided to do another one in 2020. Right. But, you know, you launched it and you started advertising, and then, oh boy, we had a global pandemic. Right. So talk a little bit about the shift, right? Because I mean, George Mason campus got shut down, right? So it was supposed to be on campus, right? George Mason, for some of our listeners, is it's a local university here in Fairfax, Virginia, and was going to be the host for the most recent hack. So can you describe the process that you went through to change the whole format from a in-person event to a virtual event?
Yeah, so I've been working on a blog post on this for like the last 2 months.
Good. This will be like a dry run for you, right?
So when the global pandemic happened, I would say around early February was when I saw the possibility of it hitting our area the most. So I'm a prepper wannabe. So sometimes I prep really well and sometimes I don't. But we came up with different scenarios of either a mixed in-person and virtual optional or completely virtual. Because I knew that there wasn't going to be a way where like everyone felt comfortable. So from the beginning, we had already incorporated a virtual hackathon or a remote option. But then by doing that, you're basically running two hackathons, which at the time I was thinking like, you know, we have to do or else we'll lose people. So we were already planning that. And then early March is when I kind of thought like, this is going to go completely virtual. But George Mason, they held on because, you know, in person, I would say is a lot better. But we held on until the governor said that the campus was closed. So that basically gave us, it was around 14 days to virtualize the entire thing. So we sent out our email to everyone immediately, to our hackers and sponsors. But what we did was we looked at it from a user experience perspective. So from a sponsor perspective, from a registered participant perspective, like what would they want to see? And one of the things about the in-person hacks is like people like swag. So we still sent swag to everybody. It was like a little care package because you got your Expedition Hack sticker and your camera cover so that, you know, if it's going to be all online, so you felt comfortable. And then all the swag from the sponsors. So that was really nice. And people still got their hard copy card schedule so that they knew what to go to and when. There was still interaction that way. And we didn't want to turn down anybody with the swag. So with the virtual, we had also like the roles laid out too, like who was the administrator for like WebEx and Slack. And even though a lot of these things are self-run, we rehearsed our WebEx sessions, which at the time, like everyone hated me for, but we found out like all these nuances of WebEx that we wouldn't have found out unless we practiced. If we had not practiced and then in front of 200 people were trying to figure out why WebEx wasn't working the way we thought it would, like that would have been horrible. So practice.
So give us one tip that you learned in your prep session.
Prep sessions meaning like the rehearsal?
And your rehearsal with WebEx. Give me one tip of something.
Practice transitions because that's probably the most awkward part for the people sitting and watching. So we had music going on, and it seems like a simple thing just to figure out music, but the audio side of it, like the person running it had like a mixing soundboard thing going on to have like the mic and the music and everything. And then also the nuance about WebEx that I was talking about, one host can't host more than one meeting at a time. Like you can attend as many meetings as you want, but apparently only one host license can only host one at a time. So we were running like multiple breakout sessions and stuff. And so, when our colleague was trying to prepare ahead of time and just set all the ones ahead of time, and then we practiced the transitions and it wasn't going, like it wasn't turning on. So we're like, what is going on? So yeah, so that's a nuance of WebEx that you would not know unless you were actually going through that. So
yep. Yeah, that could have been a serious nightmare trying to say, okay, we got to start the session now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
definitely know how that is.
A little bit. So the end result of the virtual hack. Tell us a little bit what did you learn and what did you like about what the end result was?
I think that before doing this, I felt like it was either going to be great or a big debacle. So that was part of the reason why I was like, we have to practice. And it actually came out really well. And I enjoyed working with my team. I enjoyed talking to the hackers. So the fact that people can meet each other and get to know each other in a short time period and get together and collaborate, like that's actually possible. So we are trying to actually package this as a product or service for people to take advantage of. Because especially in the academic environment, like, you know, I was just talking to, you know, you guys before this about the distance learning with our county, like how that just it didn't go well. So academia, you know, like they could really benefit from something like this, and we don't have to make a profit out of it. You know, we just want to be able to help where we can. So I think it's really important for people to realize that, you know, life is not going to be the same going forward coming out of COVID-19. It's not going to go back the way the new normal is going to be a modified version of what we had before. And we also have to remember that COVID-19, something like this can happen again. And so we should be prepared. So whatever service that we've got going on, we need to know how to virtualize it to be able to survive as a business. But to survive as a business, you have to be helpful to the people around you. So, you know, what is that niche? How are you helping? So I found something that's helpful for people. I'm not sure how to make a profit out of it. but, you know, at least like nonprofit wise, just to help and then pay our employees. That's what I care about most. I think that we just need to face facts and realize that we need to plan ahead for the next COVID debacle that could happen.
Yeah, that's a kind of words of wisdom right there. It's like I one of the phrases I think I actually detest is, you know, yeah, I'm glad you use the air quotes too, is new normal. Normal mm-hmm. is what we're living in right now, whatever that might be, right? It may be different than what the past was. And the future, you're right. The future is going to be different than what we're living in right now. So play the cards you're dealt, not the ones you wish you had. I often tell my children that. So how do folks get in touch with you, Christine, if they want to be able to talk to you about hackathons and virtualizing hackathons and expedition hacks and picking your brain, or maybe even, you know, contacting you to talk about hosting a hackathon for them?
Mm-hmm. So expeditionhacks.com. That's our website for the hackathons. And then you can just email me, Christine@bluecompass-llc.com.
Well, very cool. Well, we'll
include those in the show notes as well.
Absolutely.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
So, you know, we have we've got a few minutes left. Adam, I didn't know if you had any other specifics that you wanted to talk to Christine about. I know that, we covered a couple of the very specific things I was hoping that we would cover without me even asking a question. I know we just turned the camera on and pointed in CJ's direction and we're all good usually. I learned
well, I like to go. Yeah. So I like to understand any kind of aftermath behind studying some of the data with hacking thing. Did you? Quinn.
Sorry, it's really choppy farming. Can you repeat that?
Sorry, I'm not sure what's going on with my mic. Let me know if I'm coming.
Yeah, it's cutting in and out, Adam.
Daryl, just go ahead and take it away.
And go.
Yeah, and cut. I think what he was getting at was he was interested in the lessons learned about the data, and are there any follow-ups with the data that you were using for the last hack? And is there anything planned for maybe some other use of either the outcome, right? So the actual hack results, or the data. I think that's what I translated at. And if it wasn't, that's what he said anyhow.
Actually, there is some plan with the data. So George Mason, they compiled all the data collected from 2020 and 2018. And they're using it for as like part of their curriculum planning. And so, you know, whatever projects that they've got going on. And I guess anybody that was part of the hack can do that, because all they have to do is take from Slack like we did, because that's how we shared it out with everybody. But yeah, that it's really great data that's compiled in one nice spot. And then the aftermath, was it just data that you were asking, Adam?
Hopefully you can hear me right now.
We can hear you.
Okay. Yeah. Sounds good.
Yeah, that was a good answer. Well, CJ, listen, really appreciate you coming on the show, and Christine Young, everybody, Blue Compass LLC. You know, want to Adam and I both, hopefully Adam can hear me still. We'd like to be able to, you know, to thank you for being on the show, and, you know, come on back. We're going to do this again, and we'll have a continued stream of these with you, talking about, you know, the evolution of hackathons as you know them. That'd be really cool to do.
Cool. Yeah. I had a lot of fun. Thanks for having me. I'd do it again.
Oh, there we go. Okay. Well, thank you very much, everybody.